Strange as it may seem, however, they quote these same able thinkers and investigators as authorities in scientific research along other lines which do not disturb their own monistic hypothesis. We reject the theory as refers to man as a descendant from the animal kingdom. We assert most positively that man is not the highest type of beast, nor is he descended from beast ancestors. We emphatically declare against any author's summary dismissal of the evidence of the immortality. If the theory that death ends all is true, the valuable portion of our writings could not be written. The survival of the soul of man, after death, is a fact which is today being constantly and most positively proven through spiritualistic phenomena. Having said before that the human kingdom in nature is today as it ever has been in the past, entirely separate and distinct from the animal kingdom, that man in his evolutionary unfoldment never has been a beast and that he is not a monistic but a dualistic being, let us proceed to discuss some of the processes in the development of life as expressed in material form upon your planet. For ages unnumbered, man made but little advancement. Yet steadily was the progress of unfoldment and, when the proper time came he arose to the dignity of his full station. From the first cellular protoplasm, a so-called physical basis of life, he has been endowed by nature with grand possibilities, and with the stamp of the infinite upon his brow, man has ever moved on through evolutionary development toward the higher and nobler principles of life and intelligence which is eternal and will ever be unlimited in unfoldment. It is an immutable law of nature, that the human life a principle, when once started into activity in its association with matter, is eternal in existence and can be neither crushed nor obliterated. You may destroy the physical expression of life, but the life principle itself, even in its first stage of activity, is beyond the destroying power of men or gods, and will complete its unfoldment into the perfected human spirit in the world of effects. Notwithstanding all that can be given you from each and every grade of spirit life and spirit unfoldment, you must still, of necessity, be ignorant of the glory and beauty of the land of souls, and like the blind man who listens to a glowing description of the sun, the stars, the mighty ocean, and the flower-gemmed earth, his imagination colors and arranges these things, but when the scales have fallen from his eyes, with what wondering surprise and admiration does he view these scenes? We can only impress upon you the reality of life, a continued life, and your spiritual condition. Humanity, when it is in its mortal infancy in the unfolding years of human life, and becomes spiritual, it will more fully pervade matter. It will then be able to express itself more satisfactorily. Humanity will then advance in intelligence and refining influence more in one day than it can now possibly do in a year. It will round out into the grand circle of harmony, purity, and love. It would be impossible to make you understand the benefits resulting from this circle in which you make and hold the conditions for your spirit friends to commune with you. This is very pleasant for them and for you, but this is not all. Hundreds of stranger spirits are attracted here, and through the knowledge and power gained, they are able to commune with their own friends, or form circles elsewhere. Who is to answer for this state of things? It comes as a necessary tax for improvement on the age in which you live. The old ground of faith, authority, is given up. The new science has not yet taken its place. Men did not require to see truth before, they only needed to believe it. Truth, therefore, had not been put by theology in a seeing form, which, however, was its original form. But now they ask to see it. And when it is shown, they start back in despair. We shall not say what they see, but we shall say what they might see. If you understood the natural laws that run through their spiritual world, you might then see the truth as clearly and simply as the broad lines of science. As you gazed into the spiritual world, you would say to yourselves, "We have seen something like this before. It is not arbitrary. This law here is the same law that existed thousands of years ago. And this phenomenon here, what can it be but that which stood in precisely the same relation to the laws of ages and ages gone by?" So the spiritual world is natural, and the natural world becomes slowly spiritual. Nature is not a mere image or emblem of the spiritual. It is a working model of the spiritual. In the spiritual world the same wheels revolve, but without the iron. The same figures flit across the stage, be dislocated, and a chaos of conflicting forces, instead of a cosmology of beauty and order. You are inevitably born to the conclusion that the same fitness, law and order must prevail in the spiritual plane of creation. If man as a spiritual being, is endowed with a spiritual organism akin to his earthly organism, there must be an adaptability of these conditions suited to transformation. If he has eyes, there must be spiritual light, or eyes would be of no use. If he has ears, there must be spiritual atmosphere whose undulations flow into them and cause hearing and fill the soul with harmonies. If man as a spirit has feet, there must be spiritual earth to walk upon, or feet would be of no use to him than they would be to a fish. If he has hands, there must be spiritual objects to handle, or they would be of no use to him. If he has lungs, there must be spiritual atmosphere to breathe. If he has a heart, there must be spiritual blood to impel through the spiritual arteries. In a word, a spiritual organism demands a corresponding spiritual world which is adapted to it in form, substance and force. If a man is not organized as to his spirit, then we can form no idea of him. You are therefore driven by necessity either to deny the existence of spiritual beings, or to accept the conclusion that there must be a spiritual world, which bears the same relation to them as your world bears to its inhabitants. The spirit is the real man, and the material body only serves as a medium of communication between man and their material world. When the body is no longer capable of serving the spirit, it is cast aside and it returns to dust. Sex, disposition, character and memory belong to the spirit, not to the body, and when man goes hence, he takes all these things with him and he is just as bad or just as good when he steps upon the eternal sphere as he was in his mortal body. In short, he is identically the same being. To be otherwise, he would need to have to be recreated, and if recreated, he would be a different mortal man altogether from what he was. But the process would entirely destroy his individuality, and that would be equivalent to the complete annihilation of the man as he was in earth life, and with it would perish all recollection of friends and kindred. In a word, he would be as though he had never been. Can anything more horrible to contemplate than the destruction of your individuality, of your affections and ties that bind you to your loved ones be suggested? Each one retains his features, his characteristics and his affections with such distinctness that his earth friends, when the veil is held aside, even for a moment recognize him as readily as if he were standing by their side in a natural material body. Only he is relieved by death of all material hindrance and the obstruction of man, and space is removed. He is separated from no one in the spirit land except by opposition of thought and incompatibility of affection, which is a wise and merciful provision in the economy of existence. In the spiritual world a spirit may in a moment become present to another, provided he comes into a similar affection of love and thence into thought. In contemplating the spiritual world, you must not forget that there spirit is not limited by time or distance. This is abundantly proven in your everyday life, for you all know that distance is no hindrance to thought. You can think of a friend in England or Egypt as easily as if he were leaning upon your shoulder or holding your hand. Nor is time any obstruction to thought. You can think of Moses, Confucius or Buddha as easily as you could if they were living now in your own city. When you come into the spiritual world, you can come into communication with persons whether you know them from personal acquaintance or from mutual friends, or the records of history. And when you meet these whom you have personally known, you can recognize them, because they will appear according to the conception of them in your own minds. You carry the images of these who are dear to you indelibly wrought into the texture of your minds, and an idea cannot be eradicated from them without changing the organization of the mind itself. You carry therefore, within your minds photographs of every human being, and of everything you have ever seen, and consequently you have, and always will have the means at hand to recognize your friends. And still further, the spirit world is the place, and the only place, where friends and acquaintances and all who are connected by natural ties can meet at will. There have always been theories and speculations about the possibility of meeting and recognizing friends in the spirit world, but they have never been entertained by spiritualists, for they know by knowledge, by sight, by touch and by word of mouth that all such doubts, theories and speculations have no foundation, other than willful ignorance. Surcease from sorrow. Lord Byron. I stand here on the mystic borderland, and gaze from our world unto that of earth, and as mine eyes behold your beauteous strand I'm struck with wonder at fair nature's birth. Your hills and rocks and mountains ages old, who raise themselves like eastern kings austere, or like strong guardian angels hide the gold, in nature's bosom without guilty fear. The great deep oceans with their storm-tossed souls, who still keep beating against the shores of time, and like vain mortals fail to reach their goal, for which they've lost so much of the sublime the waves of green that in the springtime grow, until by light and air they gather grace, to enter the dark leafless trees and show at last that they are leaves on nature's face. And thus the trees at length have their new birth, and speak in raptures to each other there, and bend and laugh as if to kiss the earth, they find such sweetness in the perfume, dear. Your world within itself is like some garland fair with its rich myriad colors flower bestrewn, and looks as if there might not be a snare, yet mortals find the pitfalls all too soon. Could you of mortal life but comprehend the glorious lessons flowers have to teach, you might learn more the value of a true heart friend, and the great heights of light you'd sooner reach. Walk in the light of some bright summer's morn and pluck before 'tis crushed a violet sweet, whose little dainty face will look the dawn of love from whence it came, and you with gladness greet. 'Tis like the visit from an angel fair, to see the love light gleaming in a flower's face, and as great bowers of them grow around you there, converse with them and grow in their pure grace. Look deep into the lily's dove-like mien, and solve then if you can from whence her grandeur start. She toils not for her beauty, nor for worldly gain, and yet she is the admiration of all hearts. Learn then thy costly lesson from the beauteous flowers, they are the worthiest and the truest friends, for by their love you yet may lose the pain-filled hours, and find the consolation only true peace sends. We are like flowers and waiting for you still that we may enter where we've knocked before. We stand in throngs your longing hearts to fill with gems of beauty from our glory. Sure you do not see the glories of your world, because the shine of money dims your sight, and yet you would not wish to enter here, and bear the darkness of a long, long night. Far better that you turn your vision then to flowers that bear our message of sweet love, that we may to you precious presents send, from our celestial regions here above. If mortals will but aid us, we can give to them such precious portions that their cares will cease, they will be taught to look towards heaven and live, and from their bonds of darkness find release. The Divine Order of Nature's Laws. Emanuel Swedenborg. The world has always had its great leaders. In the realm of science, literature and philosophy they stand like heralds on mountain tops proclaiming the dawn of a new day of whose light they catch the first rays. In the march of human progress there are patriots inspired by spiritual influences, by a keen sense of justice and liberty, who forge their way to the front and lead the people into higher forms of government. There are those who delve into the secrets of the universe and find new forces of heat and light. There are those who peer into the skies and discover new planets. And what is true in regard to the realm of nature is true as to the realm of spiritual phenomena. The time ought to be past when one receives his teachings as a child. The time is at hand when you should use your own faculties and investigate for yourselves. Men in authority as religious leaders ought to be given to understand that what they give out to the people of the world must tally with facts. People who implicitly believe in religious leaders are robbed of many privileges. They are blinded by prejudices caused by ignorance or misrepresentation and deprive themselves of truth that would illumine their minds and give joy to their hearts. You say these things are known. We say that never in the history of the Christian Church has the people given forth such uncertain and conflicting sounds as exist at the present age. The only truly satisfying doctrine that prevails today and has prevailed for ages and ages and that has given scientific and rational proof, is spiritualism. As a result of our progress, we have had intelligent advocates in the centers of civilization for centuries and centuries, and have searched nooks and corners of the world not dreamed of by mortal man. But the question is sometime raised why such wonderful privileges are granted to us. The time was and is ripe, and men were found to answer the purpose. We have found men and women through whom could be made known the rational truths of spiritual phenomena for the good of mankind. What minds more fully trained in all the sciences, devoutly disposed, earnestly and sincerely seeking to find souls in their homes, that we could impress our presence upon them? This truth is central to all other truths, and without perceiving which the scriptures cannot be rationally understood. This is the light of everlasting oneness, and we are able to see through the dark recesses of one's soul. These truths enable one to avoid the errors that are involved in the extremes. To Christianity, these teachings show that however defective they may seem in the light of science or Christianity or in story, it is nevertheless a perfect vehicle of truth, because the sense intended is spiritual and written according to the law of correspondence between natural and spiritual realities. It is shown, however, that there is no salvation by faith alone. It is grounded in charity and results in shunning all evils as sins and in the faithful performance of one's daily duties, making clear that it is impossible to separate the three constituents of the truly Christian life, love, faith, and good work, without all of which there is no salvation. If it is indicated that evolution is the divine methods of creation, it is also shown that there is no evolution without involution, that it always is and has been true that something cannot be created from nothing, that intelligence cannot be evolved out of matter, and that although the order has been to create successively, man has been immortal from the beginning, though the higher capacities were not enjoyed until he became regenerated. It is sufficient to fit man or woman for the higher gradation of spirit. It is also shown that man or woman is not regenerated instantaneously, but that regeneration is a progressive work involving the constant cooperation of man and the constant operation of all spiritual knowledge, which is the law of all being. If it is pointed out that man and woman are created, a form of the love of self and the world, it is shown that they are orderly loves from creation if subordinate loves, and it is also made clear that they are created with heavenly degrees of mind, which can be opened more and more interiorly, thus making it possible for you to be born from above. If the teachings that the death of the material body is according to divine order, as they would have it, it is also the teaching that if sin had not been introduced into your world, there would have been no disease and untimely deaths. Man would have fallen asleep when the body no longer responded to the requests of the soul. If in these teachings that there is no resurrection of the material body, the fact is made to stand out clearly and prominently that there is a resurrection of man in a spiritual body, and in which body there is contained all the faculties of a human being, the male remaining a male and the female a female. If it is pointed out there is no Romish purgatory, it is made clear that there is an intermediate realm into which all persons go after the change called death, and where the ignorant are instructed and where all are helped that have any real desire to be helped. The intermediate world is not a place where character is formed, but where what has been involved is evolved, where the concealed is revealed. But if the work of real repentance has been begun in the material world, the work of regeneration and thus of preparation for the heaven they speak of, can be continued in the region where the spirits will come to all the comers from the earth and minister to such as really desire to overcome the love of self and the world and become heirs of salvation. The fact is revealed, however, that there is no reincarnation, no coming back again into material life in another body of flesh. It is because you are shown that there is plentiful opportunity in spirit life for the unfoldment of man's and woman's nature. It is taught that heaven is a state, not a place. It is also made clear that those who become receptive of the life of the kingdom of God have an environment which is a perfect expression of their state of life. It is an evident fact that the devil is not one great monster. The devil is within you. Don't picture to yourselves that there is a great monster waiting to devour you. The possibility of communicating with spirits is conceded. It is also declared from experiences what good is evolved by coming into conscious association with those who are in the spirit world. For the purpose of accomplishing certain ends, as in the experience of sure prophets, etc., it is useful, because effectual under the divine law and under the care of natural laws and trust according to order of things, but in some cases it subjects man to great danger because he comes under the influence and control of deceiving spirits who know man's weak qualities and use their subject for selfish ends. It is therefore a fact set forth that man is in constant association with spirits as to his interior life. It is maintained that the orderly state in which one should live in unconsciousness of the fact, and that you should look to us, spirits, alone for protection and strength, and what is needful for man to know of a future life has been and is being revealed by the spirit world. But says someone, where are the credentials? Am I to believe without evidence such stupendous claims? The credentials, friends of earth, are, in these and the true phenomena woven around them, the proof of what we say are in the daily fulfillment of matters and things concerned in your daily lives, of which things we have prophesied much. If the truth will not convince a man, nothing will, for miracles close the rational mind while truths open it. We are here giving you thoughts that none but the finest trained minds and the most pious hearts could write. Here are thousands of sentences like polished crystals and the most beautiful cut diamonds, and the light they reflect is the light from the spirit world, for they reveal the secrets of earthly conditions in your world. These forces are like telescopes, they bring near the things that are far away in the dim distance of bygone ages and make them reveal their secrets. What is above all else noteworthy, you are brought face to face with us. There can be no faith without freedom. It is not faith to attempt or pretend to believe the things which you are told you must believe. Even to seek to comply is to prove your fear rather than your faith, your apprehension of some dreaded consequence attendant on failure to conform. To say, I believe, lest a catastrophe attend the honest denial of such belief, is to play the liar and the coward. It is far better to have no faith at all than to weakly submit to a matter of opinion. And it is sufficient not only to one but to many other people, and it is worth arguing with, on its scientific side. If you take a wide view of spirit phenomena, a view in which alone the true analogies of things are to be clearly perceived, you will find that whenever these phenomena have been rightly understood, there has been a continual progress and advance along the development of a higher spiritual life. Science cannot, and does not, deny the fact that progress and advancement are by far the most constantly represented forms and conditions in life. Were it otherwise, you would not find the universe so varied as it is. This being true of physical things, why not concede that it is true of spiritual things? It is held by a few, and a few we are glad to say, that spirit manifestations beyond the point of obtaining satisfactory evidence that man is immortal are hurtful and should not be encouraged, but we hold that it needs no spirit manifestation to demonstrate the fact that life is continuous, nor that the natural and spiritual worlds are separated only by a mere veil which may be drawn aside almost at will. The leaders and teachers of men in all ages of the world believed and taught that man should live after the death of the body, but aside from these teachings, the belief is inbred in every human being that man does not go into everlasting nothingness when his mortal body ceases to breathe, and he therefore need no other evidence based upon faith alone than that given by his natural longing after immortality. But what of the knowledge and demonstrated theories which spirits possess? Are they not valuable to you, and should you refuse to be taught by the wise and the ripe in experience, who have gone to the other shore, and offer you the benefit of their experiences and observation? Most certainly not. At best you see through a glass. The doctrine that the universe is in the hands of a creator so unjust, so cruel as to decree your eternal damnation unless you subscribe to statements you cannot endorse, or blindly to insist on the historic accuracy of incidents which you would discredit in any other relation, is ineffectual and without foundation on truth. The real difficulty in religion for the average man, however, lies not in the credibility of the historic statements of the faith, not in the logic of their syllogism. He is even willing to take many such things for granted. The difficulty lies in seeing any particular value or use in such articles of creed and history. He cannot see why their acceptance should be regarded as the most vital thing in life. At heart, every man who lives above the brute is religious, that is, he desires to realize in some way those soul and character ideals that grow within him and shine before him. Men will not be satisfied with a faith that fails or does less than this. He cannot see how the perfunctory acquiescence on his part with the formal statements of the creeds would aid to his end. Suppose you throw aside other considerations and accept the Mosaic cosmogony, what light would that throw on the struggle in your soul and the divine? In what way will that help you to altruism? The truth is that the church faiths are of yesterday, of which true faith is of today and forever. Faith is the hope in embryo of the future, it is the confidence born in the heart of man that life holds better things, and thereby aids in life onward pressing, the finding of much valuable knowledge. The faith that dwells within you mortals of earth, is that which fills you with calm assurance that there is a goal, that the universe does not mock you, that the hopes and aspirations that burn within are but pulsations of the mighty law of life in creation. The faith that there was once a perfect man is an empty thing unless it becomes the power that pushes you on to nobler perfections, unless the facts of the past become for you the prophecy of the future. All the history of the soul's direction toward it is a promised country. You must believe the past whenever the past shows the race coming into the fuller present, rising from lower levels. The statements which men call faiths are commonly but the dead shells that once contained glowing life. They are like photographs of a sunset, the form is the but the glow, the color, the life has gone from it, into the realm of spirit. Each age has its visions, facing the future, looking forward with high hopes and bright dreams it sees the spirit realm. Then comes the heartographers, who care nothing about the spirit realm so long as they make its maps. They draw lines and lay on colors, they describe, prescribe, bound and limit that which their fellows of larger heart and hope have seen as a living glowing spirit. Thus from the visionless minds you get your creeds, or descriptions of yesterday's faith. We do not believe that this age is less spiritual or more sordid than its predecessors. We know indeed, precisely the reverse. But, however, this may be in the minds of some. Is it not plain that if spiritualism is to be moved by the remote speculations of isolated thinkers, it can only be on condition that their isolation is not complete? Some point of contact we must have with the world in which you live, and if our influence is to be based on widespread sympathy, the contact must be in a realm where there can be, if not full mutual comprehension, at least a large measure of practical agreement and willing cooperation. Philosophy has never touched the mass of men except through religion. And, though the parallel is not complete, it is safe to say that science will never touch them unaided by its practical applications. Its wonders may be catalogued for purposes of education, they may be illustrated by interesting experiments, by numbers and magnitudes which startle or fatigue the imagination, but they will form no familiar portion of the intellectual furniture of ordinary men unless they be connected, however remotely, with the ordinary conduct of life. Critics have made merry over the spiritual philosophy which represented man as the center and final cause of the universe, and conceived the stupendous mechanism of nature as primarily designed to satisfy his wants and minister to his entertainment. The material world, howsoever it may have gained in sublimity, has under the touch of science lost in domestic charm. Except where it affects the immediate needs of organic life, it may seem so remote from the concerns of man, that in the majority it will arouse no curiosity, while of these who are fascinated by its morals, not a few will be chilled by its impersonal and indifferent immensity. If in the last 100 years the whole material setting of civilized life has altered, you owe it neither to politicians nor to political institutions. You owe it to the combined efforts of those who have advanced spiritual light and those who have applied it. If our outlook upon the universe has suffered modifications in detail so great and so numerous that they amount collectively to a revolution, it is to men of science you owe it, not to theologians. But science is the great instrument of social change, all the greater because its object is not change but knowledge. And its silent appropriation of this dominant function amid the dim of political and religious strife is the most vital of all the revolutions which have marked the development of modern civilization. But if it be remembered that this process brings vast sections of every industrial community into admiring relation,